misunderstanding about what we do in our practices. The first misunderstanding is the reason why I've been using the sole term anesthesia. You know, anesthesia is a continuum, and I hope we all understand that. But when I read a recent letter from the president of the Arizona Nurse Association, Nurse Anesthetist Association, it doesn't seem like that concept was quite grasped. And I think maybe this committee, as it endeavors to look and change the rules, we might want to revisit our definition of anesthesia and appreciating that it is a continuum. So our administration of anesthesia, really in any setting, but certainly specifically to the dental office setting, is the entire spectrum from minimal sedation to general anesthesia. And I think just by virtue of understanding that, it doesn't make a lot of sense of why we would change the rules, other than I think it's just a misunderstanding of what that is all about. In light of that, the other issue that has come up that I think it's important for the committee to consider as it's going through its review is this consideration for drastically changing what the Nurse Anesthesia Association is putting forward as access to care. And the concern that I have is that access to care is being misconstrued with safety. And at the end of the day, I think we enjoy the right and the privilege as a profession to regulate ourselves. And how we decide to regulate ourselves are decisions that we should be making and not have others make them for us. And it's disconcerting to me when I read that letter again, because it indicated that we're doing a number of things wrong, and there's always room for improvement. I didn't necessarily agree with all those points, but one thing that sort of impacted me was that this idea that we're not even involving nurse anesthetists with our discussions and deliberations, and it's my understanding, unless I'm mistaken, and please let me know if I am, but I'm pretty sure we have a nurse anesthetist that's sitting on the committee currently, which would be in contradiction to what was asserted in that letter. So I think as a profession, we've done a really good job of being inclusive of the different types of anesthesia providers that are going to our dental offices. But I don't think it's about making the pathway easier for those providers. I think it's more about making the pathway safer for the patients that are being treated in our offices. And that's really where I want to sort of focus my comments. My concern is that if we were to shy away from enforcing permits for the different pathways of how sedation or anesthesia, since we make that distinction within our permits, are administered in the office, we open the door to greater adversity and less safety. And I think we all know, if you look statistically, the majority of adverse events are usually associated with minimal or moderate sedation versus deep sedation or general anesthesia. So I think our focus needs to be on how we regulate dentists appropriately. And I'm strongly opposed to a dentist not having some level of qualification, whether it's a permit that they've obtained through training or education or residency or otherwise. They should have something in place if any provider is going to be coming to their office. Now, one different pathway, as we are all aware, is respect to the dentist anesthesiologist, which is a different animal in the sense that that provider brings their permit with them typically. But we also know we have mobile permits for other provider types as well, and that permit travels with them. But I think ultimately a permit needs to be in place and should be in place for anyone that is involved with the administration of minimal sedation to, or moderate sedation, excuse me, to general anesthesia. And so I want to focus on that from the perspective of making sure that we're doing what we can to ensure that safety for our patients and understand that this is for our patients' well-being and not for someone's ability to get into an office easier. I certainly agree, which is why I had submitted a letter to this committee when it first started, that we can possibly make the permitting process easier and maybe improve it, but I don't think it should be removed. And I think that's an important point to focus on. My concern is that we don't as much have a safety issue with respect to our current state of permitting and regulation with our profession of dentistry as much as we have a regulatory issue. And really that regulatory issue is with our other provider types. And my greatest concern is with CRNAs. It's my understanding, and again, I'm open to anybody correcting me if this information is wrong, but we have had two recent deaths in the dental office setting, and both have been with the involvement of a CRNA. What concerns me about that is we have no opportunity, and again, someone can help me with this, but I'm not aware that the board has been able to understand, know, or otherwise be informed of any kind of investigation or other type of response to the actions of those deaths by the CRNA. And my understanding it was the same person, but again, I could be wrong. I think that's a big problem. And I've reached out to the nursing board, and I have done this on previous occasions as well, but I find them to be very resistant to participation. I find them to be very resistant to transparency and openness. And so I struggle to understand why we wouldn't want to ensure the utmost safety for our patients with regards to any provider type and making sure we have systems in place to protect our patients. And right now, I don't think we have something in place for that with respect to nurses going into offices. And so that's a concern for me. And I hope it's a concern for the committee as well. But at the end of the day, I think that's really the issue we have to address. And I do think there needs to be a regulatory pathway in place to ensure that we are at the first, foremost, and forefront of all of this, considering patient safety, which should be our primary, and not access to care. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Caputo. We won't discuss this since it's a call to the public, but it's going to be a good segue into another agenda item. But before we do that, can we put on record that Dr. Christensen joined the meeting at 1:10 and Dr. Beanstalk at 1:17? And Ryan, did you have any comments?
So this is Ryan Edmondson, board staff. Just because the meeting is held virtually and in person, it's probably worth when we say it so that we have an accurate record of who's speaking, even those that are present. Our minutes administrator, Andrea Cisneros, is present virtually, so she won't see who spoke. So each time, if you just want to say German or Blazik or whatever, and then speak, that would be helpful. Additionally, for those that are participating on the phone, with the exception of Seth Hargraves, our assistant attorney general, who may interrupt for legal reasons, those that are participating telephonically to wait till you're called upon, either by a committee member or probably the chairperson of the meeting today, Dr. Hero, that would be helpful. Lastly, and I think Dr. Hero already alluded to this, but the goal, I think, is to get through the majority of the topics that we can discuss in open session prior to going into executive session to review the adverse occurrences. So with that, and in light of wearing these awesome accessories on our face and physical distancing, we'll try to stay in this room to keep that. Otherwise, you go into the executive session rooms, they're considerably smaller. And that way we can probably disconnect from the virtual attendees, with the exception of Seth and Andrea Cisneros. If there's a reason that we would need to meet or that we're going to do something after, we can always post something on this site to allow people to reconnect, but there won't be anything probably discussed post the executive session. And with that, I'll pass back to you.
This is Hero. So we'll move to agenda item number 8, the Arizona Association of Nurse Anesthetists letter, which our call to the public just discussed. So we can open it up to discussion amongst the committee members at this point for that agenda item.
You have a copy of the letter? This is Blazik. Do you have a copy of the letter?
It's in the packet. On page... This is Ryan. It would be on page 169 of the packet. If you go to the top of the PDF, it should, by two arrows, just to the right of the arrows, you can enter the page number, just type in 169, hit enter, and it should take you right to it. For the record, this came from the Arizona Association of Nurse Anesthetists. They wanted the board to review it. The board reviewed it on January 29th, and they essentially punted to this committee, which is why this committee was developed to begin with. So the board has already looked at this, two of which are sitting on today.
And I guess I'll make, this is Hero, just some initial comments, just mainly for a background, which we all know, but I think it's important to recap it. One, the board formed this committee because obviously they take patient safety very seriously, especially with regards to anesthesia. We also wanted a diverse group of practitioners on here, hence dental anesthesiologists, general dentists, pediatricians, oral surgeons, MD, and CRNA anesthesia providers. The way the rules are set up right now, there is no restriction to practice amongst any of the providers in this room. There's permitting for the dentist to go through just to make sure that their qualifications are up to speed so that the board feels that they can safely practice on patients who are under anesthesia. So I think it's important to recognize that there are not restrictions in place right now for who can go into an office and who cannot. But I'll turn it over to the rest of the committee.
This is Pagai. I just want to put this out there as we look at this, is that my involvement on this committee is with me as an individual CRNA. What the association does is a decision by the board, which I am a member of, but I'm only one voice on that board, just like I'm one voice on this committee. Just to give a little bit of insight as to why the board elected to send in this letter and move on some other things that we'll discuss later, I'm sure. After the board meeting and then this committee's meeting where a local oral surgeon came on and said some things about CRNAs that we did not feel were accurate or justified based on isolated incidents, our association's board felt that more action was necessary. And that's kind of where this is coming from. My stance, as you all know, was the changes that we approved and are planning to recommend to the board. I, you know, wanted to continue that process, and I still do. And this is more, in some regards, a bit of a reaction to some of the things that are being said by our profession as a whole based on isolated events that occurred. So, and I will, to some degree, Dr. Hero, disagree with what you said, that everybody can practice in the same way without any restrictions, because the permit process does place restrictions on physician anesthesiologists and CRNAs because of the requirement of that permit that we aren't able to get, that we aren't able to go from office to office. So I appreciate your input on that, but I don't quite see it the same way.
Okay, thank you.
This is German talking. Just a comment, maybe an observation, is that from the onset of this committee, I think Ali has pointed out his concern regarding access to care. And that, I think, is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's been one of his big pushes in this committee, which I agree with. I think access to care appropriately and safe is important for all providers. And Ali was doing this through the appropriate channels, which was this committee, independent of what your association decided to do. So I think we were approaching this topic in parallel with what your association is trying to do as well. And I don't necessarily agree with the way the association is now pushing this through law when I hope we were trying to address this as a committee. But that's just my comment, my observation.
This is Dean Stock. Does anybody know if the nursing board has an adverse occurrence reporting requirement?
They do.
So did we ask the nursing board if they knew about the fatalities? Did they respond to a request?
This is Ryan, board staff. So they have been pretty obstinate. Like, they're not giving us a whole lot of information. We passed on to them that there was a CRNA involved in both of these dental treatments. treatment cases. We've contacted them, and Lisa or Selena can help me on this, to follow up. And like us, they have confidentiality statutes, so I don't think that they're planning on sharing anything until they can. And so we don't know even if the nurse anesthetist reported to them, but they did get it from us too. So he may have done it as well, but we don't know.
So according to Dr. Skiparis's notes or observations, I should say, is the better word, informal study that he conducted, that general dentists and CRNAs were responsible for 50% of the adverse occurrences in this state in the past 7 years. So that's a concern, because as a dental board, we have no way to even do anything about the CRNAs who are involved.
This is Pagai. Correct. It's the nursing board's obligation to regulate CRNAs, just like it's the dental board's obligation to regulate dentists, and it's the medical board's obligation to regulate physicians. Dr. Harris reported on 2 events that were involving a CRNA. Today, I think we're reviewing 17, correct?
I think it's around 28.
So around 28, 2 involved a CRNA. We're going to look in more details in executive session as to those events. Neither one, as far as I know, the investigation is complete. I know they were both deaths. From what I understand, one was related to local anesthetic toxicity that was administered by the dentist. The other one was related to an airway fire that was a result of use of a laser by the dentist. So to claim guilt before an investigation is complete seems a little bit of a step too far ahead. And I will say this, every profession has people that need to be investigated. It was the same individual provider in both those circumstances.
This is Blazek. Ollie, can you give me a rundown of what the protocol is for a self-reporting? And is there, for an adverse event, is there a difference between if it occurs in the hospital versus when they're out practicing in, you know, a surgery center or a private office? Is there a difference?
I don't know the exact details. I never served on the board of nursing, but I believe it is very similar to the same as it is in the dental community, that if you have an adverse outcome, you're supposed to report within, 7 days or 10 days or something like that. There's mandatory self-reporting for adverse events, substance abuse. There's a whole list of things that you're supposed to mandatorily report for. And if you don't, then the consequences are much greater.
And then this is Blazek again. I'm just curious as to why this is on our agenda, just because the letter that was sent to the board, it's a hot topic, or
Well, if we're done with this topic, it's probably a good segue to the next one. But ultimately, the CRNAs have an issue with, which Dr. German also has addressed, that it's the access to care. And because of that, They're basically trying to influence the committee, and I use that word probably too great, Ollie, but they're trying to influence the committee in the direction that this committee decides to go to recommend anesthesia and sedation regulations as you present them to the board. Without going to the next topic, I don't know if we're done with this one, but I'll let you guys decide. But essentially, they've also dropped a bill across the street. And I say across the street because the legislature is across the street from where we're sitting here at 1740. And what it attempts to do is change the law regarding anesthesia and sedation, which I believe Dr. Caputo also addressed. And I don't think he addressed the specific bill, but that's the attempt is to help CRNAs because I believe, and I don't want to speak for the association because I'm not an advocate for the dental board or the association. I'm an employee of the dental board and will do what the dental board directs me as staff to do. But what I believe it attempts to do is to create an anti-competitiveness with what they believe is right now a challenge to get through in order to treat patients. And if we're done with the letter, we could probably skip to the next one.
This is Chris.
I just had a few things to say. I just wanted to hold back because I'll probably try to keep it brief as I can, but there's a lot to talk about for this topic, for sure. And I think it really comes down to jurisdiction control. And in a dental environment, we're here to protect the patient's safety. It's the whole mission of the board. And their influence is in that dental environment, in that facility, and also on that provider itself. And there's statutes out there, such as ARS 32-12-07, that talk about the regulation of supervising personnel, provided that the regulation is based on the degree of education and training of the supervised personnel, the state and scientific technology available, the necessary degrees to supervise and supervise the personnel of the dentist. About the educational qualification that falls onto the dentist in that facility. The issue, the disconnect with this, is that we have two boards. We have a regulation board that can permit dentists because we are dentists, but they're unable to permit non-dental anesthesia providers. So what has been done ever since I've been in Arizona is a 1304, which puts that responsibility solely on the square of the dentist and the facility itself, where they have to say, who is this CRNA or this MD physician anesthesiologist coming into this facility that I have to ensure that safety? You can have someone that's been in administration for 10 years and not have hospital privileges and come into a dental office. They need to know that information. There's nothing precluding that. And I don't think the state of Arizona is trying to preclude that. It puts the responsibility of knowing if there is an adverse event, that they have some avenue to be able to track and tag that situation. I do understand the concerns about the latency of acquiring the 1304 permit, but in all due respect, you know, even your Board of Nursing Practice Act for the state of Arizona talks about credentialing taking 120 days. Everything's taking long. Even our own permit as a dentist, I think, takes a long time. And what we haven't seen or has been proven is that there's a major discrepancy between permit providers at all. I haven't seen it. I know you say it. I believe you. But I don't know those numbers just to be able to focus in on that key issue, which I think was the big issue for why you're here today. I don't think the nursing board has taken the appropriate action. I do not feel like they're directionally correct at all. And I think they need to really take caution for that. I mean, because they are going to be abrasive. The dental community as a whole will know what the nursing board is trying to obtain. And I don't think that's going to go well. I mean, I really don't. In Mississippi, we've seen the same action happen. And quite honestly, it didn't pan out well for them. What ended up happening is the board said, and rightfully so, we understand that we don't have jurisdictional power or authority. We do over this dental office and this facility. So the person that's going to be solely responsible for that has to be educationally qualified. That means I'm not going to tell you you can't do anesthesia, but this dentist is limited to what type of anesthesia they can do in their facility by the educational requirements of that dentist. So if he only has a moderate sedation permit or minimum sedation permit, and he wants to bring in a CRNA, that's the only level of sedation that can happen in that type of environment. I don't want to see Arizona go down that way. I'm not advocating for that. I'm just telling you and your board, and it's something to reflect on. Is it true that the board's mission is to look out for the safety of the dentist and their patient in that dental facility? And do they have the right to have some kind of way to engage that for the patient? We talk about access to care. I know that's a key hot topic, but as been pointed out, we have to ensure safety. That's the only reason that we're here. I do know between my group and I just did a quick analysis, and it's not to grandstand or say there's not an access to care issue or anything like that, but I do know that there's providers in all four corners of Arizona. For the last 2 years, we just did a quick summary, and just with our group, and Jeff's group's probably bigger than mine, we have services for 500 docs, over 320 locations. We've treated close to 18,000 patients, and of those, 14,000 of being accessed are on Medicaid. So that argument of access to care, we need some kind of data to show that overriding principle foreshadowing or overshadowing the ability to take out sedation regulation completely in the dental environment. The thing that is a touch irritating is that we all want to be here, as pointed out, and I'm glad you're here to advocate, and we all have different perspectives here. But we're in the sandbox, we start throwing sand in other people's eyes. You have to question, well, I'm not in a hospital setting. None of us are on a nurse advisory panel board, or none of us are advocating to deregulate nursing. I don't think it's about deregulation. I think it's about addressing the true concerns. If there's a latency or if there's some kind of barrier for you, they're trying to rip out and claim jurisdiction with crazy expenses, and I don't think it's going to pan out well. But I hope that we can all focus and work together, because you guys have something to contribute to the society, to our community. We all do, in different perspectives. But, you know, pulling out sedation into the regulation, that sounds like the most craziest idea I've ever heard of. But that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Dr. Christensen, did you have a comment?
Oh, I appreciate everybody's comments here. I think, along with some of the comments that were made, I think every facility has an obligation to, be able to self-regulate itself, by the permitting process. I'm in favor of the 1304 permit. I think it helps, it's a checkpoint for all of us to be able to ensure that the safety that's there has at least a minimum, safety, requirement. And I think you go into any hospital, any surgery center, you have to be permitted to do that. You know, are there things that we can do to help with the permitting process? I believe there absolutely is. I'd like to see. I know we hear about that it takes a long time. I'd like to see the number of those cases that are actually out there before we keep using that term that it's been holding up access to care. So I'd really like to see those instances in those offices where they had those issues. But I think what's been said here has been very valid. And the letter and response that was provided by the board, I appreciate that. And we're here to help each individual and profession and the safety of our community. So thank you.
This is Blazik. One more question. Ollie, when did Arizona pass the revised the Medicare requirements for anesthetists to practice independently? When did that happen?
So there was a bill, SB 1336, that passed in 2016. That was that was a quote-unquote surgeon immunity law that said that physicians and surgeons who work with CRNAs cannot be held liable for their acts or omissions, basically saying that the CRNAs are solely responsible for their actions when they perform anesthesia or provide anesthesia. So that was one piece. And then it was last March that Governor Ducey signed the opt-out letter, opting out of Medicare supervision,
right,
which the opt-out doesn't really apply to dental office. The opt-out is Medicare Part A billing, which is facility billing that.
So the independent practice that I'm thinking of, wasn't that, I thought, in early, like 2012 or something, that allowed really CRNAs to practice independently from having an MD oversight? And I thought that was a federal thing as opposed to a state-by-state thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're right on both, but it's okay. Different. CRNAs have been able to practice independently in the state of Arizona ever since CRNAs came into statute in the
Okay.
However, there always had to be a physician present, and it wasn't quite clear what that meant. And so it got clarified in statute in 2016.
Oh, okay.
When you're talking about of the Medicare supervision,
okay.
Conditions of participation for Medicare billing under Part A of Medicare, the facility must have in their requirements that CRNAs are supervised by a physician, which is non-defined. So it's been used multiple ways. Individual state governors are allowed to opt out of that requirement. And last March, Arizona became the 18th state to opt out of that requirement. But as I mentioned, that's for facility billing, so it doesn't really,
I understand.
Yeah.
Not related.
You know, in some manner, it shows something, but it doesn't actually apply in the dental anesthesia marketplace. So, can I have a few more moments? You know, I appreciate you guys' concerns. I think you bring up a good point about us having data to show the access to care, and you know, I'll mention that to our board that's something that should be there when making a request like this. I do want to reiterate, I'm an individual here today.
Yeah.
I'm not here as I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not here as a representative of the Arizona Association of Nurse Anesthetists. You know, one thing you mentioned, Dr. Brady, was regards to, you know, knowing where anesthesia is and who's responsible and having those dentists permitted for it. You know, as it stands right now with the mobile permits, whether, you know, you can have a mobile 1301, 2, 3, or 4. And so there are individual dentists with those permits that are able to go to different places, and the board doesn't necessarily know where anesthesia is, as far as I know, or is it needed to be reported when you go to a different facility with a mobile permit?
So this is Brady. I think the differential thing with that is that with the mobile permit for the 1304 is that the board is able to permit me as an individual. They can pull my permit. They can take away the privilege to do anesthesia services. They can do a lot of things with me because I'm under their umbrella and oversight, where they don't have that necessarily with non-permitted anesthesia providers. So they have to put the permit somewhere. I think that's like the disconnect between all of that. Yeah, there's many ways to kind of, I think, help your situation out with getting into locations that would work for everyone and put us kind of on the same equal playing ground, so to speak. If this is more of like a, hey, I don't feel it just because I want to do all this dentistry, but I have this extra burden on me. So I do think there's ways to do that, but that's the reason why. From my perspective, we're different educational backgrounds with different abilities, and the dental board has a lot more authority over me than it does to you or a non-anesthesia permanent person. So they have to permit somewhere to have that safeguard and that safety net in place. The thing that I fear is if you take that away, then it goes back to the dentist that's involved. And it's like, okay, you're going to have to do only anesthesia up to the level that you're permitted to do if you're bringing on adjunct people to come into your domain to do anesthesia. Because they have no oversight besides the dentist himself. So that's the issue that I see. And so, you know, when they do that 1304 permit, hopefully they're looking at things, hey, is this non-permanent anesthesia provider, have they lost hospital privileges in the past? Have they been in administration their whole life and now they just want to do dental anesthesia? I mean, there's a lot of things to consider. But there is no permitting process for the board to say, oh, you're qualified and you're not qualified. They're going to have that permit through that 1304. But I think we can make a better system. I'm all about it. But I think pulling that out is going to be very challenging.
Yeah. This is Bagai again, and, you know, very good points. I will say the legislation of removing sedation from statute that you've referred to, a couple items on that, I think, as it relates to this conversation. For one,
I'm sorry. This is Hero. Can I interrupt? Let's move to the next agenda item because we're kind of touching all on that anyway. Let's,
okay.
You know, just to kind of keep it moving along.
Yeah.
So we'll move to agenda item number 9, legislative update. Before you continue, Ryan, if you want to just read the latest, there's been an update to it, I think, since.
Probably.
So So if you want to do that and everybody's on the same page, then please go ahead.
Sure.
Yeah, so the legislative update is essentially, it's on page 175 of your packet. Let me share my screen for those that are attending virtually. Give me 1 second here, Dr. Hero.
What page are you on?
It looks like 175. So those that are attending telephonically, I don't know who you are, but you won't be able to see this. But essentially what there's been about 1,600 bills that have dropped across the street, which is an amazing task for staff because we can't hire lobbyists to also do that research. We're tracking about 68 or so that affect dental board directly or indirectly. The one that's probably the reason why I put this on here is just so that I'm essentially giving you the exact same thing I gave to the board last week ago today. But the biggest concern, obviously, is the elephant in the room. And Ollie, you're looking very thin, so I'm not calling you the elephant. Especially me. I need to get out and probably do some biking or whatever. But Senate Bill 1372, it's a bill that if you look in the, I'll highlight it on the screen for those that are attending. And Dr. Caputo alluded to this, although not by bill number. This was introduced by Senator Barteau, who happens to be the chairperson of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee at the Senate level. The way the bill was dropped was an introduction, and this is, I believe, where Mr. Begay was headed. But it was used as a striker vehicle, and without insulting anybody's intelligence or getting into the nitty-gritty about how bills are moved through the legislature, strikers essentially, they use vehicles after they can't continue to introduce bills, and they'll move a bill based on new language that will come at a later date. So the bill as you see it today, where it says basically eliminating sedation, is not the way it will look. The board met last week. They strongly opposed this bill. They asked me on behalf of the board to basically indicate that, along with another bill, which I actually think is probably something that you probably don't want to oppose, but that's another topic. So I've already indicated the board's opposition to Senate Bill 1372. In addition, they wanted to send a letter to its member associations, which include the Arizona Dental Association, the Arizona Hygiene Association, and the Oral Maxillofacial Surgeons Society. Coincidentally, the Oral Maxillofacial Society's member that received it is on your committee, Dr. Eddie Christensen. One of the signers of the letter is Dr. Hero. The other signer is Heather Hardy, who's the board president. It went to all those people and then copied to their lobbyists. From that, we found, which we already probably anticipated, I was pretty certain I knew who dropped the bill, was the Nurses and Anesthetists Association, whose lobbyist also represents the Hygiene Association, which clear, and she may be present. I don't know if you want to speak, Jesse, if you're present. But ultimately, that's how I found out that it was the Nurse Anesthetist Association that dropped the bill, and that they're also using it as a striker. So the way it reads today, let me get there real quick. All right. And it may have been updated, but it hasn't. So the way it reads today, let me stop sharing and I'll share my screen again. And I'll share my entire screen this time. So if those that are attending virtually, you'll see me jumping around. Just sit tight as I move through screen. So this is the bill as it's introduced today. So it's introduced Senate Bill 1372. The prime sponsor is Senator Barteau. But if you scroll through it, the only real difference is under And this, by the way, affects rule or statute only. Everybody understands they can only change rule. Statute, not rule. The board would help formulate the rule. So under 32.1207, A14 or B14, it says establish criteria for the renewal of permits issued pursuant to board rules relating to general anesthesia and sedation, and they've struck out and sedation. Continuing on further, the very next page, it says prescribing educational and experience prerequisites, and they've struck for the administration of administering, they just struck the administration of intravenous and intramuscular drugs, and they struck for the purposes of sedation, or they struck for use of and using. So what it will be now, and you guys are going to have to give me a second here as I scroll through again. So here's the same bill again. And the committee members, if you have your screen, if you go to the top, there should be like a go to the internet. Oh, did we not put it up for them? We didn't, right? Okay, pardon me. So you're just going to have to follow along. 32.1207 is extremely modified. 1207E. And for those that are attending virtually, you can see it more than those that are present. But essentially it says, and I'll just read it in this, but I believe this is where Mr. Begay was headed, that it's a striker vehicle. And so it's not very long, so if you'll just indulge me for a second, it says the board by rule shall require that a licensee, this is all current, obtain a permit for the application of general anesthesia, semi-conscious sedation, or conscious sedation, shall establish and collect a fee of not more than $300 to cover administrative costs connected with issuing the permit, and shall conduct inspections to ensure compliance. That's where it ends currently. The addition is a licensee who has not obtained a permit pursuant to this subsection may perform dental procedures on a patient who receives anesthesia administered by a qualified anesthesia provider who shall be exclusively responsible for the pre, intra, and postoperative anesthetic management of the patient. A qualified anesthesia provider may include a physician who has completed residency training in anesthesiology and is licensed pursuant to Chapter 13 or 17, which I believe are the professions of this title, which is Title 32 is all medical professions. Or a certified registered nurse anesthetist who has a national board certification in anesthesiology and is licensed pursuant to Chapter 15 of this title. A physician or certified registered nurse anesthetist who provides anesthesia services in a dental office shall satisfy equipment, facility, and monitoring requirements consistent with the national standards for dental anesthesia adopted by the board. That's all new to E, and then F is brand new. An adverse anesthesia occurrence involves an anesthesia provider that is not licensed by the board, which would be the dental board. The board shall report the adverse anesthesia outcome to the regulatory board that licenses the anesthesia provider. So that's the new language that they're going to present to Bartow. She probably already has it, to be honest. And that will be the vehicle by which it moves through the Senate and across to the House. And I'll pass it back to Mr. Begay.
So this is the guy. I do want to address the original language that was deemed crazy in all capital letters in our packet. And it's to your point earlier, Dr. Brady, in medical offices, this is me just thinking of why it might have just been that to set up the striker. In medical offices, the DHS regulates general anesthesia in medical offices. And there's a requirement in medical offices that they have a certification. For sedation in medical offices, there's no such requirement. So a medical office that wants to do sedation in their office for procedural sedation, I can just go in there and provide, you know, moderate sedation. So I think that may be why it was originally like that. but that was never intended to be the complete language. So I don't want to be here today to debate the language. I think that's for the legislature and stakeholder meetings and all that. So, but I just want to give a little bit of background, because once I saw crazy Bill in our packet, I saw just a little bit of, and thank you for covering all that, because I think that covered much of it, but just give a little background that that wasn't part of it. And I will say this, in a medical office, whenever sedation or anesthesia is administered, there is always a single individual that is wholly responsible for the administration of sedation or general anesthesia. The person doing the procedure is always only doing the procedure, which isn't necessarily in the case in dentistry, where when I think of it from those lenses on, yeah, it is absolutely crazy to think that there's no regulation for sedation when that's going on. So.
Yeah. We'll send this updated bill to all the committee members so we have an opportunity to read through it. I don't know how much more discussion you guys want to have on this right now, but, I mean, it's open.
Well, this is Blazik, and I would agree. I think you just move on. Our role here is zero. We have nothing to do here as a committee. We can't do anything other than talk about it. And where do we go from here? So I think we're kind of wasting our time on it. Yeah. So
well,
I think
and if I can address it real quick, if the board wanted the committee to know about the board's opposition, and you guys, for the most part, maybe belong to one of these associations. And if that is your, if you share the same belief as the board, and not the board, the board did not vote unanimously in opposition. A couple people were absent. And then I believe there was at least one that voted against the opposition. So, that being said, as the collective board, like Mr. Begay keeps saying, as a group of people, they've opposed this bill, and they sent a letter, which I can also, I'll send you this along with the opposition letter, just so you guys can see that. And if you wanted to try to influence your own associations, member associations, in having them oppose it, they would have a lobbyist like Jesse to meet across the street. So that's the purpose for this and nothing more.
Could I ask one question?
Yes.
The board chose to oppose, and I'm sure they may come out and oppose the new language too, but
right.
I just want to be clear, the board opposed the original Stryker bill that just crossed out sedation, correct? They did not oppose as it stands.
Right. That's a very valid point. They opposed it as the original introduced language, not the Stryker language. And they may still oppose it. I don't have any idea. They haven't seen the new language, correct?
So just out of curiosity, this is Blazik. Out of curiosity, Ryan, how did that work then? So this, do you just submit it to them by email? And how fast does this process occur? And how does that, I'm curious. I mean, is it like next week they're voting? Or I don't.
Yeah, so this is Ryan, board staff. So by the time the board looks at this again, it will have probably, it moves this quick. I mean, it could happen. The Health and Human Services Committee in the Senate, they meet every Wednesday. Christina, help me. The Senate meets every Wednesday, I believe at 9 a.m. And the House meets every Monday at the Health and Human Services Committee at 1 p.m., I believe, right? Not when we met. Yes, 1 p.m. And that one is the chairperson for that is Joanne Osborne. The co-chairperson is Dr. Cobb. Dr. Cobb is a dentist. In the Senate, it's Christina, help me. Bartow is the chairperson, and the co is it Shope? I don't know. He's got tons of medical.
Osborne and Cobb are from the House.
Mm-hmm. This bill is in the Senate, though. In order to get to the House, it has to pass all the way through the Senate because there is not a mere bill in the House, so it would have to go across. So, but I'll send you this information. We will, to continue to answer your question, Dr. Blazik, I'll give this information to the board. Dr. Hero already has it because he was a signer to the letter. I thought it was important that he also saw this. He's probably not in a position to say today whether or not he is in favor or opposes the current language. But I think it's a good idea that we probably pass it on to the board.
This is Blazik again. So what's this one here? SB 1504 permits dentists and hygienists to administer influenza and COVID-19 vaccines.
This was also kind of another bit of a surprise.
Yeah. I mean,
we found out later that the Arizona Dental Association did a sunrise process to do, to introduce vaccine or vaccination. And so apparently it went well and they're moving the bill across. So 1504 will allow all licensees of the board, which currently is just dentists and hygienists, but eventually will also cover dental therapists as well, to give the vaccination of both, just those two vaccines. There's several boards across the nation that already allow it and have discretionary authority to do it, like if a pandemic happens, because you guys have the ability to treat people.
Because dentists have zero experience giving deltoid or gluteal injections. And hygienists have zero experience. So that we're going to, in a broad stroke, give them the license to go ahead and poke someone in the deltoid or the glute to get it.
Yeah, so you have to read the bill a little bit further. You have to have specific training and stuff like that. But
oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Dr. Blazek, I would go to you for my vaccine. Deltoid, by the way.
I've given
not,
a few.
Not the glute.
I've done a few.
This is Christensen. Just wanted to thank Dr. Hero for involving you know, the dental specialties that are out there too. And we're actually in the process of putting the letter together as well. So thank you so much.
Definitely. And like Dr. Blazek said, I don't think there's much discussion needed on this, but it was relevant information given that we're an anesthesia committee that's going to give advice to the board. So we'll get that information sent out to everybody on the committee so that you guys have it. Let's move along, if there's no more discussion here, to agenda item number 7, benefits of a team model, two-provider model, or a single-provider model when administering anesthesia and sedation. I'll turn this over to Dr. Germain and Dr. Blazek and Dr. Christensen for discussion. And everybody else.
Who wants to swing first?
You go ahead. You can talk about the what each one represents, I guess, so just everyone knows, two-person versus one-person. And versus team, I guess.
Yeah, so I think this conversation has been, I think, popping its head up frequently over the last, I guess, year now we've been meeting. And I think in light of last meeting's conversation, I think it would be best to table this after we've actually looked at the cases so we have more facts. Is that reasonable?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's very reasonable. Go for that.
Okay. So any more comment on this agenda item? All right. Why don't we take, it's 2:03. Why don't we take a 7-minute break in case anybody needs to freshen up. And after that, we'll go back to agenda item number 4 and probably the executive session.
Cool. So for those that are attending virtually, this is Ryan Edmondson, board staff. We will leave this line open. But we're going to mute it so that, because they're going to stay in this room. I'm going to create a new executive session line, Seth, for just to separate the two different recordings. And then just of those that are participating virtually, Seth and Andrea Cisneros will receive the invite. And then so we'll come back real briefly, probably just to make a motion to go into executive session. We'll set that up during the break. Thanks.
They won't tell us.
The due date's July 20th.
Is 218. So moving along to agenda item number 4, framework guidelines for the study review of adverse occurrence reports. This is going to set the framework for what we're going to talk about on the next agenda item, so there's not much discussion to be had on this one. So we're just going to move to agenda item number 5, study review of adverse occurrence reports, and I will make a motion that we move to executive session for this agenda item.
Second, Brady.
Any discussion?
Well, you need to be specific for going into executive session.
I amend my motion to make a motion to move to executive session for legal advice regarding review confidential information. Would you like to amend your second?
I second that motion, Brady.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
This is Board Staff. So those that are on the open session, it's okay to stay in here. We're going to disconnect our phone, and we're going to contact the executive session link. You're welcome to stay, but this is probably all they'll discuss. They'll come out and maybe, I don't know exactly how it'll go from here, but you're welcome to stay to find out where it does go from here. But give staff a second to get into executive session before we start having the conversation. Seth and Andrea, you're welcome to just exit the virtual room you're in now. And I sent the link to you, so you can probably access that there. I'm going to jump over and make certain.
wait a second. Yeah, when I'm speaking, if I turn the mute off in the other room, it's the dots are moving. Can you see in the open? My dots are moving in the open if I'm unmuted. Yeah, we just want to make sure that it's not being picked up in both.
She said it's silent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys can hear me. I'm only in the open session right now, though. I think we're good. Yeah.
Okay, this is Hiro. We are back in open meeting. Any more discussion on cases, or do you guys want to wrap up?
I just have a clarifying point, and I'm looking at Dr. German only because the staff's going to put together something. Would you mind if we send you, because I don't want it to come to the committee and then the committee's like, this is not at all what we want. And then if you guys as a committee are okay with Dr. German's like kind of oversight.
Okay. I'll look at it with him.
Okay. So we'll send it to both, and then you guys can comment back what we missed or where we should be, and then we'll bring it back to the committee.
Perfect.
And then that'll be presented in kind of spreadsheet format for us to be able to view and discuss.
Yeah, we'll probably have models and stuff.
This is Bagai. Will we go through the rest of them as a group, or you guys want to just?
Are we not done?
We didn't go through all of them.
We did?
Yeah, oh, a few more floating around here.
But
we can go through them.
I mean, I'm not saying do it today, but.
Oh, yeah.
How many are there? Three?
I got one here. I think there's some more in the box that we didn't get.
They're not all mine. They were just getting piled by me.
there's not many more. I think I have like 19 counted.
No, not 19 more.
No, we've already done that. I mean, we're close to 20 that we've already done. How many were there? 28?
There's 28.
28, yeah.
Are you guys okay if they just include those in that Excel sheet and Dr. Blazek and I?
Good call. I think so. I mean, I don't think
they have another executive session.
That's a good point.
Is that fair or no?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dr. Brady.
I think that's a good way to go about it, unless there's something that's like really kind of deer in the headlights or something revolutionary, then we can maybe go into the executive session again. But I think having you two doing a summary report on the rest of them would be great.
Even given Dr. Blazek bias.
Sure, it's all going to come to vaccines.
All right, let's move to agenda item number 10, discussion and possible action items for future meeting agendas. I have more of a question, and it's probably going to be something that you and Seth are going to talk about. I think it'd be great if when we get these adverse occurrence reports, instead of a single consultant reviewing it, if there was a way to send it to committee to have it reviewed in real time. I don't know if that's an option because we had to pull the two pending cases, but I think it's we can ask Seth about it and see if there's something we can do.
There are boards that have committees, but I think those committees are set through statutory authority that those committees then do investigations and then recommend. But it's not a bad idea to establish, and it doesn't have to be this makeup, because some may not want to continue on something like this, but we can look at it and get statutory authority to have kind of an investigative committee and then make a recommendation. And then you get a ton of people that have expert knowledge, and then the board doesn't have to spend their time making maybe an improper decision or something.
This is Brady. I support that. That's exactly what we did in Mississippi as well, and they're just two-year appointments from the board at that point. So you're asked to be on it for there's a set time window.
I think that would be good. I think it'd be great. I mean, the idea, I guess, would be keeping an anesthesia committee like this going in perpetuity just with rotating members on it.
And have the various specialties represented,
exactly.
Including CRNAs and MDs, I think. I think it would be good.
What I've seen be problematic, and the consultants, God bless them, I mean, they don't get paid. It's a ton of work that they go through, but oftentimes you're getting, an oral surgeon evaluating a dental anesthesiologist or something where it works, but not that well, rather than like to like. And the benefit of a committee is we could avoid that. Something to look into.
That's definitely a good idea. And if they establish a committee under statute, it would be, not that it's a ton of money, but there would be a paid per meeting type of.
This is Brady. You need to inform Mississippi.
This is the guy. We can add that to our striker if you guys want.
Yeah. Good idea.
You got it.
Well, then it would have to pass.
Bingo.
Real quick, since we're on the same topic, you said something in executive session that I think is relevant for open session for future meeting agenda. Do you remember what that was, Dr. Brady?
This is Brady. I say a lot of things. I don't remember much.
I didn't know if there was something that you wanted on a future agenda to review as a committee.
I guess my overall question. We were we brought up really good talking points and things to flag and to consider to look at later that I believe is captured in executive session minutes.
Okay.
But I don't remember what I
said. This is Blazik. Was it what I asked about, which is what we define as an adverse occurrence and how things differentiate between something that comes to the board that there's no action versus something that comes to the board that there is an action? And are those all considered adverse occurrences? And what are the reporting criteria? I know it's in our statutes, but I think we should talk about it.
Okay. Yeah. We'll make sure that's number four on the agenda. We'll put that back on.
And then this Blazik again, and I'd have to say that this is certainly one of the most productive meetings. And I think it's because we itemize our agenda to making it pertinent facts or something isolated that we could talk about. For example, the one provider model, two provider model. I mean, I think that's a meeting in and of itself. So with all due respect, I would like to suggest that when we decide what the next meeting is going to be, let's limit that agenda. That allows us to have a truly, you know, competent meeting, and we can know what the topic is well in advance, so we come into the meeting prepared to talk about it and make some real valued input and decisions that will move forward to changes in the statutes.
Zero, I think, is a great suggestion, although I thought you were going to say it's because I was chairing the meeting that way.
For sure, yeah.
There's nothing else, we can move on to agenda item number 11, next committee meeting dates. We just send out that time.
Yeah, I'll do Tuesdays and Fridays, morning and afternoon, and then wherever we have the greatest majority, that's what we'll pick.
Are we thinking these are going to maintain in person, or are we going back to virtual?
We can go to virtual, because I don't think that there's going to be a need to review files again.
Yeah, I mean, this was nice. It was
really nice.
Yeah.
Thanks for the change.
Yeah.
You people.
Yeah. We can offer it like we did the last meeting where we did hybrid, because these are not well-attended meetings. Everybody in the audience of staff, we could do these hybrid. The governor's office doesn't want big meetings that can draw big crowds. Our board meetings could get like that, so those will probably still remain virtual.
All right.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming. I mean, I know this is a lot of time on a Friday afternoon, and it's really valuable for the board, and I think we're, like Dr. Blazik said, it was very productive today. So on that, I'll make a motion for adjournment.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Andrea.
There you go. Good job. I
have to go down.
Meeting in a month or meeting in 2 months?
Yeah.